Hello, y'all. This is Scott Merrick from the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, welcoming you to the brand spanking new bi-weekly incarnation of Snacks for the Brain.
If you've been listening, I don't need to tell you that this is show number 38 of what has been a weekly podcast. Well, y'all, starting today, we're going to go bi-weekly
and longer.
By adopting this new longer format, you'll be able to hear entire PodSafe music songs from now on. You'll, of course, also continue to hear exciting interviews with cutting-edge working research scientists and outreach professionals, as well as interviews with top-notch educators who are striving to prepare our students for the incredible exponential change with which their future world will, without a doubt, challenge them. There will be the occasional sound scene tour of Music City, USA, and the rich set of experiences Nashville has to offer the world. Who really knows what we'll cook up here? All I know for sure is that there's going to be tasty, tempting, tantalizing snacks for your brain. Snacks for my brain. Snacks for the brain.
Listen up to Once Upon a Summer Day by the Monica Herzig Acoustic Project. Yeah. Check them out. So here, ladies and gents, friends and listeners, we'll be listening to some jazz, we'll be listening to some acoustic folk music, we'll be listening to some alternative adult music, we'll be listening to some techno, some house, some trance, some ambient, all kinds of music that I'm going to be able to pull from the Podshow Music Network and other sources. So stay tuned. Right now, listen up to an interview I conducted very recently with Dr. Albert Reynolds. Al Reynolds runs a teeming, very busy research laboratory at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and we talk a little bit about what he does, why he does it, and other things. I certainly hope that you'll enjoy listening to his very succinct explanations of some very technical stuff. Al does a great job of making it accessible. So listen up as we discuss cancer research with Dr. Albert Reynolds.
So we're here with Dr. Al Reynolds. Do you prefer Al or Albert?
Al's fine.
Al's fine. And Al is a cancer researcher of renown and has recently received a faculty award for excellence in research at Vanderbilt University. And I'll link to that in the show notes. But I finally cornered him. I finally got him together to sit down and talk about what he does because it's pretty fascinating. And we'll just get into it. Your primary focus in maintaining this lab, of how many workers?
12.
So you've got 12 workers in the lab. That's you and 12 others?
Yeah, it's myself, the three technicians, two or three postdocs, and five or six grad students.
That's a lot of people, though. I mean, that in itself is a job of work, just sort of keeping those people on track, right?
Yeah, it's a lot like running a small business. People don't think of research that way, but that's basically the way it is. You get funding from the federal government. You have to write research grants, and if they score mm-hmm. well enough, then you get funding. That funding covers, at least at a place like Vanderbilt, not only your salary, but salaries of other people as well.
So you've got a pretty big budget here. You have to, in order to maintain all this work.
Yeah. I mean, it's about $1.5 million a year budget.
So this is one lab in the research, huge research building, the Preston?
Preston Research Building.
Yeah, the Preston Research Building, which is dedicated to cancer research.
Yeah.
I know that you have a primary focus in your cancer research. Can you briefly explain that?
Yeah, my own is on a protein or gene called P120. We discovered this a long time ago, 15 years ago, and at the time it was related to an oncogene called SERC, which is the first oncogene ever discovered, actually. And we didn't really know what it would turn out to be, but when I started my career, I went and started my own lab and started working on this. Since then, it's turned out that it binds to a major cell-to-cell adhesion molecule called epithelial-cadherin. And there's been a lot of interest in that because when a tumor makes a transition from being sort of a benign tumor that a surgeon can take out to one that is malignant or metastatic, E-cadherin expression is generally lost.
Hmm.
Okay, so you have this major, probably the major cell-cell adhesion molecule in epithelial tissues. And these are the tissues that give rise to 90% of human cancer. And it just shuts down. And it's part of the process of the tumor sort of forgetting what it is and being able to move off into other areas of the body.
Wow. You know, you just explained that very technical concept to me so that I sort of understand it. I hope our listeners also understand. Fascinating. So this molecule that sort of goes away when the tumor becomes malignant is really your focus of research, yes?
Yes. I mean, that's true for E-cadherin, what I was just talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Right,
the protein we discovered, actually, I mean, this protein, E-cadherin, spans the cell membrane, so it binds to itself on an adjacent cell on the outside, and that's how it holds two cells together.
Mm-hmm.
On the inside, it's regulated by proteins that bind to it, and P120 is one of those. So for a long time, we didn't know what it did, and then we found out it bound to E-cadherin. And then it turns out that it regulates its function, so it regulates the strength of cell-to-cell adhesion.
Hmm.
And you recall that I said it was initially, you know, connected to an oncogene. It turns out that oncogene, that is a gene that causes cancer, acts on P120, and that affects cell-to-cell adhesion. So it's probably, you know, a continuum. It's a part of the bigger picture of what goes on in cancer.
So you're studying this whole behavior of these related mechanisms, yeah?
Right.
And how do you do that? Do you do that with human subjects, or
No. Actually, it's ultimately important to look in, like, human tumor tissue to kind of find out what's happening. But as you can imagine, it's that's not that easy to do. And of course, you can't do experiments in humans at all. So most of what we do is actually in cells. The technology is just so advanced now. You can go into a cell line that has been derived from a tumor, and a lot is known about it, and, you know, grow the cells in culture, and then you can, what's called, you can knock down the protein that you're interested in selectively. That's relatively new technology, just in the last 3 or 4 years that it's been possible to do that. So you can knock it down, and see what happens. In this case, the cell-to-cell adhesion. And when we did that with P120, the entire E-cadherin complex just dissolved. It just was broken down. So what we learned from that was that P120 was essential for stabilizing the E-cadherin protein at the cell surface. And, of course, if that can't happen, then the cells can't adhere to one another.
So basically you're sort of hot on the path of, we hope, some sort of stabilizing mechanism that might be replicated and used in treatment.
That's part of the implication of it. You know, it's been known for a long time that downregulation of E-cadherin is relevant to metastasis. There's quite a bit of pathology literature out there. You know, you asked if people look at human tumors. You know, a lot of these tumors, you know, when they're taken out of an individual, you know, just as part of a standard cancer therapy, the tumor's preserved, and then scientists look at them. So they looked a lot at E-cadherin and had seen that it goes away or is turned off in metastasis. And then more recently they looked at P120, and it happens quite frequently with P120 as well. So, you know, people didn't know quite what to make of that. But now with the data that I just described, you know, where we can knock it down in tissue culture and watch the whole cadherin complex go away, kind of puts a new meaning to it, because it means that, you know, P120 and E-cadherin have to act together in order to be normal. You know, loss of either one is probably going to contribute to metastasis.
Wow. That's just really interesting. That's cool stuff. So I understand you just finished submitting a large grant proposal, so your life has recently been very much tied into that. Can you talk a little about the process of grant submission? I mean, that's a large part of your job, as I understand.
It is after you've been running a lab for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start out, it's just sort of you and a tech and a couple of people. So you get one grant and you work for a while. But when the lab gets to be big, this is a fairly big lab. Mm-hmm. You spend a lot more of your time just writing grants and sort of it's like administering a business. So it's pretty much the lifeblood. You've probably heard this publish or perish.
Right.
So it begins with that. You have to publish at a reasonable level, which means publishing in good journals and publishing a reasonable number of papers, because you're just not going to get funding if you're not putting out, you know, if you're not using the money well.
So you're publishing all the time as well. So
yeah, sure.
You have a number of jobs in this job.
Yeah, it's like running a small business where you're sort of the jack of all trades, except that the one difference is when you get to this size, you just don't get an opportunity to really get out in the lab much anymore. You're sort of supervising everybody else, and they're putting the time in.
Do you miss that?
Oh, a lot, yeah.
We have a life flight going up off the building.
Yeah, it comes over several times a day.
Well, I would imagine. Those people do good work. I'd love to interview them sometimes.
Sure, they have a lot of stories.
Yeah. You can actually hear the windows vibrating as the helicopter goes overhead. Cool, audio color! So, yeah, you said you have to publish at a reasonable level. I have to confess that I went and counted your publications at your medical center staff profile page, and I came up with 73 on that web page that was just recently updated. Well, not recently, updated in March. So I assume you've probably published something since then.
A couple.
So let's call it 75, listeners.
That's probably right. I mean, the publication just never ends, but it's kind of hit or miss. Sometimes you have a good year and a number of things come out. Mm-hmm. And then other years you just sort of get delayed and there's one or two and you sort of, you know, people start sweating it, feeling like, I mean, in general, with research, you're kind of looking into the unknown, so you never really know where the next hot piece of data or discovery is going to come from.
But that's exciting, yeah.
Yeah, it is, and it's a little stressful, too. But they just, you know, they do tend to show up every year or two. There's something new that's exciting that you you know, will base your next round of research on.
Mm-hmm.
But the grant process is kind of rough. I mean, right now NIH is at an all-time funding low. So, now what that means is about 10% of the grants getting funded.
Ooh.
So you can imagine, I mean, that's 10%, and your competition is the best in the world.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not quite like judging art, but you know, when you're projecting the future and writing a grant and trying to say, okay, we're going to do this and that to find out something, but you're trying to find it out. You don't know what the answer is going to be. And then your peers are judging that and trying to, you know, sort of figure out if that is the best of the 10 grants they're looking at.
And basically, you're asking the funders to take a gamble on the work that you will do in the future.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why the publish and perish is so important, because really the best thing they have to go on is your track record. If over the years you've done a good job and made discoveries that make a difference, they're willing to take a bigger chance.
Because,
you know, writing a grant, you know, if there's a fine line between creative and just plain crazy, you know. So you get a little more of a break if you have a good track record and you've been doing it for a long time.
And if you can do both, you've got a shot at the Nobel Prize, right?
I suppose. You know, there's somebody who won a Nobel Prize not that long ago for a technique called PCR. It's sort of this repetitive DNA amplifying technique, which is, you had to be a little nuts to come up with it. And it's one of the biggest discoveries of the decade, really. Everybody uses it.
But
if he had applied for a grant on it, he might not have gotten funded. So, you know, that's the pretty good example.
That's tough. So do you sleep a lot? Do you sleep at all? How do you get all this work done?
Well, I work a lot. I work too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the way this profession works. Most of the people are successful, particularly if they're running pretty big labs. You know, I work a lot on weekends and nights and... You know, I mean, that's just part of it. The pay's pretty good, but it's not like being an MD, like a doctor, an MD doctor, a lawyer. And the hours are long, but on the other hand, you kind of get to be your own boss, too. If you can succeed and bring in the funding, you know, nobody's really telling you what to do. So, you know, you have PIs, you know, scientists, you know, you have the image of the crazy scientists, but they all do have kind of their own schedule, so you can come in late, and then go home and work till midnight, but you can be pretty sure that all of them are working longer than normal.
Yeah, you can't not do the work. You don't have to do it on somebody else's schedule.
Well, oh, yeah, because you're just not going to get funded.
So when you do wake up in the morning, is this the sort of work that you envisioned yourself doing as you were going through your college career? And where did you get your education to do all of this?
I went to Kenyon College, a small school. I was a biology major.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I really couldn't imagine doing this kind of stuff. I mean, I couldn't really even read it back then. It's highly molecular. You know, a lot of gene splicing, you know, stuff like that.
And the human genome wasn't mapped, obviously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, things have come so far since then. It wasn't even close. But, you know, I kind of thought of myself as becoming sort of, you know, my vision was one of those National Geographic guys who go to an island, study the Komodo dragon or something. But when you get into graduate school, you know, you it's like anything else, you learn, you move into these molecular areas and become familiar with them. And
and that's where you did your graduate work at the same college?
No, I went on to University of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a reproductive biologist there. And liked that fine, except that, you know, near the end I was real. That was when molecular biology was just coming around. All this sort of manipulation of DNA, it was becoming pretty clear that that was the way to go if you wanted to really learn something.
Yeah, prior to that, it was pretty much science fiction, wasn't it?
Well, you know, 20 years prior to
right.
that. I mean, you know, people forget the DNA, the discovery, the structure of DNA was in 1953 with Watson and Crick.
Right.
Not that long ago. And that was just the discovery, the structure, all the technology had to sort of come out of that.
Let me get away from the professional questions for a minute. What do you do for Al? What do you do for yourself for relaxation outside of work and outside of your career? What do you like to do?
Mostly I like to stay in shape, and we go on a vacation once a year for a couple of weeks, just go to the beach and chill out and read. novels, you know, something different. But and I kind of fool around the stock market and play with stuff like that.
The stock market game. Cool.
Yeah, but that's a lot harder than doing science. That's pretty unpredictable.
Well, neat. Maybe you could take the listeners on a little brief tour of the lab and sort of describe it to them. I'll take a few photographs. And before we leave this conversation, do you have any predictions for where you think your field is going? If you can imagine it 5 years from now with all the exponential growth that's happening and discovery, where would you like to see it?
Actually, it's pretty hard to predict. I mean, all of this stuff aimed directly at sort of slowing or preventing or getting rid of cancer.
Right.
And it's really hard to do because a cancer cell is not that different from the rest of your body. You know, there's just been a few mutations where it doesn't behave, which of course kill you down the line, you know, but it's like when you go try to kill a cancer cell without killing the rest of the body, it's pretty hard to do. So with the advances in molecular biology and the cloning of the human genome and the fact that we basically know the identities of most of the oncogenes and tumor suppressors involved, we kind of know how cancer happens. But it's still pretty hard to get in there and selectively kill it without killing the person. So it's hard to predict. I mean, it's moving so fast that I guess I would see it going toward individualized medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, I mean, you wonder why somebody can smoke, you know, till they're 120 and not get cancer, and somebody else smokes one cigarette and gets lung cancer and dies when they're 40 or something. You
right.
know, there's huge genetic differences between all of us. And the technology is getting so advanced that you can almost figure that out now. And I think in 5 years, you're going to be seeing a lot more of that. You're going to know who's going to be allergic to penicillin and why, things like that.
That'll be an interesting time to be living through.
Yeah, and applying it to cancer may make a big difference.
Cool.
Navigation side note. For those of you who are listening to the podcast without having looked at the show notes page at snacksforthebrain.blogspot.com, check that page out because there are some photographs that illustrate the next section of the podcast. This lab is a very, very interesting place, as the pictures describe and the sound seeing tour illustrates, and I'm really looking forward to Al participating in the video conferencing virtual lab tour that he herein commits to doing.
Hey, so we're wandering through the lab here.
The microscope room. It's actually a common microscope room that we do that we run for the cancer biology department. These are expensive pieces of equipment.
Wow.
There's probably $500,000 worth of stuff in here. So over the last few years, we've pulled resources and gotten the sorts of things that people need. That's a laser confocal microscope. We can make movies of live cells. In other words, you know, cells kind of like a flower opening, they move pretty slowly.
Mm-hmm.
But you can make a movie over 24 hours and study the movement. And there's things you can do that way that you can't do any other way. But you also, you can imagine, have to have some pretty sophisticated imaging software.
That's amazing.
So,
these are big microscopes.
So, okay. And actually, it's unusual to find it open like that. It's usually, you know, filled and running nonstop. So, these are just benches. You know, people have all, in labs, people all have their own schedules, so they come and go when they want. If you came in here at 9 at night, you'd find two or three people working. I suspect this is pretty much running from 8 in the morning to about 3 in the morning. You know, just depending on who's working and when.
Whoever's got a key. No, we're standing next to what you're hearing here is an Environ shaker. And it looks like we've got a bunch of, beakers in there?
We grow bacteria in that. They have to be aerated all the time to grow well. And basically, with molecular biology, everything you do is in bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
You grow the, you know, if you're growing DNA, you clone, or cloning DNA, you clone it into a plasmid, The plasmid is a circular piece of DNA that grows in bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So you grow the bacteria up, they multiply quickly. The next day, you get them back out, the DNA back out.
Cool.
So that's how you make DNA.
Then you have something to work with and study.
Yeah. And all those bacterial strains are special. They can't grow in people. They're all, you know, engineered to be, you know, like a white mouse that's so domesticated it can't survive as soon as you put it outdoors, you know.
So there's no danger inherent in those bacteria getting out.
So this is a room, just since people can't eat in the lab because of chemicals and things, we have a refrigerator and it's kind of a break room where they can eat their lunches.
And surf the web. And do work, too.
Not everybody has their own personal...
Oh, here's a story. I saw the article on your wall about this piece of equipment. This is a belly dancer. I think I'm getting in here. Come on now. Now, Al, who invented this piece of equipment?
Well, I guess you could say it was me. I started all this when I was a grad student. I ran a little company. And got a little too busy as a postdoc to do it, so my uncle took over. And he's run this company ever since.
Wow.
But I have a few patents, and this is one of them.
So this is cool. There's like flexible tubing that serves as a little leg. And the thing is, I should do a little movie of this real quick. The thing is rotating. This would be a fun little addition. There's your belly dancer. And what's on top of there, Al?
Those are Western blots. It's a way of detecting detecting proteins.
You'd just like to maybe sit on top of that thing and just sort of let it carry you away, eh?
Well, it's sort of the way you would mix things by hand if you were going to. We have to mix things all of the time. We can sort of adjust the pitch and just adjust the speed to get the motion. You know, you can see how they're just moving around just
mm-hmm.
a little bit.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you want to do. And the other thing is just an off-center cam with those legs, so it just never breaks. These things run for about 15 years.
Looks like this one's...
The simplicity is actually... it's greatest virtue. There's not a lot of moving parts. It doesn't break, and this is what people need it for.
Well, very cool.
Just graduate student desks.
Ooh.
When they're not doing experiments, they have to write and read.
Great. Reading and writing. And a lot of arithmetic, I'm sure.
Yeah. So this is another lab with benches and just people doing experiments.
Well... You know what I'd love you to do sometime is I'd love to get my tech guy up here and do a virtual lab tour for students. You think that'd be a possibility sometime?
Sure.
He would follow you around just like I'm following you around and do basically what we're doing here. But the difference would be that at the other end of the camera would be a classroom or three classrooms full of kids somewhere in the world.
Okay.
Cool.
So this is a tissue culture. You know, all the cell work has to be done, you know, it has to be sterile.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want the cells to grow and not bacteria. And if bacteria got in any of this, it would just grow like crazy. So these are sterile environments. The air is filtered and they work behind that in the sterile air. As you can imagine, it has to be almost foolproof.
Yeah.
Because you just couldn't do this. So these are the incubators. This is where we, you know, those have a certain CO2 environment and temperature that allow the cells to grow.
Cool. Now, will light cause any damage to these?
No.
Okay. Let me just take a quickie here.
So all of those plates have cells in them.
Well,
most of the experiments we do,
cells.
No bacteria. The bacteria are used to make DNA, which we can put in the cells or...
Gotcha.
You know, for experiments.
Very cool.
So this is a pretty standard lab at Vanderbilt. You know, different labs have different equipment
depending
on what they do.
It's quite a busy place. And as you've described, I bet you only have about, you probably rarely have all of your people here at one time.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool.
And that's actually one of the advantages of a life in science, even for the grad students. You know, nobody's really micromanaging. Well, now that's real different depending from lab to lab. You know, each mm-hmm. lab is like a small business, and the PI
right.
runs it differently.
Right.
So I don't really micromanage. Some people do. But I think in general, you know, a lab environment is one where you work odd hours, you work long hours, but...
Well, I can tell by what you said earlier.
It's not like an 8-to-5 type. You have to be here.
I can tell by what you said earlier that the flexibility is something you value, and it's good that you're passing it along to your employees.
Well, it's probably too much work to do it any other way, really.
Right. Well, cool. I guess I have to thank you for this wonderful conversation, and I hope I can do it justice in the post-production. And I'm hoping that you'll allow us to get together and do a virtual lab tour using the video conferencing technology sometime, maybe next year. Maybe if you've got a slower time of the year, we can go ahead and schedule it. Ooh.
That'd be fine. It's there's no such thing as a slow time of year, but
right.
you just want to avoid the grant season.
And what is the grant season, generally?
There
is
isn't
it springtime
one. It's you know, every
whenever they
every
fall.
Every 3 or 4 months are deadlines, and... you know, you get past one, if you're lucky, you don't have to do it again for a year or so. But my problem is I'm up to about 5 grants, so I'm sort of constantly, you know, every 3 or 4 or 5, 6 months, you know, having to sit down and spend a lot of time with it.
Well, certainly wish you luck on the one that you just submitted. And if our conversation is any indication, a lot of luck is not necessary.
yeah, I don't know. You always need some luck on these things.
Well, thank you.
Yes, I thank you, Dr. Albert Reynolds, and the world thanks you for the hard work you do every day, putting the pieces of the puzzle together to seek a cure for cancer. Musical exhibit number 2 from Snacks for the Brain, episode 38. Want to call to your attention a woman from upstate New York whose name is Happy Rhodes. That's R-H-O-D-E-S. This remarkable instrumentalist, vocalist, and lyricist has a vocal range of 4 octaves. You'll be hearing more from Happy Rhodes. Listen up to this song, All Things.
I had another accident. accident last night. I tripped over a saw and fly. Must have dented the ship, 'cause my memory fades while I patch the damage. Tell me of your escapades.
That's Happy Roads, y'all, from upstate New York, and also from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Check her out, and while you're there, check out her own personal website. It's fabulous and fascinating. Let's move along!
Nanny, nanny, boo-boo, listen when you want to.
Tech tip tidbit for you.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's Tech Tip Tidbit. A tasty snack so good, you'll wonder why it's not fattening. Let's talk about linked versus embedded sound in PowerPoints. Do you use a lot of music in your PowerPoint presentations? Do you then use these presentations on a different computer? Ever had a problem with the music? Maybe the music you've used isn't on the new computer and you didn't know that you had to copy that file too. Oh no, what do you do now? Well, you could always train yourself to copy sound files, or you could take a minute or two to find out what rules PowerPoint is playing by, and then see what options you have. I vote for the second choice, since it puts the knowledge and power in your corner. So let's take a look at what PowerPoint is doing behind the music scene. Here's the deal. PowerPoint has a setting in the options window that's a cutoff for sound file size. Below the specified file size, PowerPoint embeds the file into the presentation. No need to copy embedded files to the other computer because it's already in the presentation file. This, of course, means that sound files larger than the size will be linked to the presentation, but not as a part of its file. Linked files must be moved with the presentation file. To make changes to this cutoff file size, you'll need to go to the Tools menu, Options choice. Once in the Options window, you're looking for the General tab. There's an option that says Link sounds with file size greater than kilobytes. This is the setting you need to pay attention to. If you want larger sound files to be embedded, increasing the size of your presentation file, you can increase this number so that the files you're using are below the cutoff. When you've made whatever change you deem necessary, click OK. Voila! To embed or to link, it's all up to you.
This tip was written by April at worldstart.com.
Check it out. If you like these tips, be sure and go to www.worldstart.com and subscribe to their weekly newsletter. Well, that's it for Snacks for the Brain, episode 38. Snacks for the Brain is brought to you by the fine people at the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out their website at www.vanderbilt.edu/CSO. I'd like to leave you today with an example of what one talented woman with a drum machine and a 12-string guitar can come up with. This is Amy McLean from her CD entitled Utah Girl. See ya!
It's wonderful. Something I can. need something I can wrap my head around today. Please give me something I can wrap my little head around today. Raging water, well, I'm sitting like a stone, barely notices the flow, and I'm gliding on a windstorm. Well, I'm flying trouble. Something is wrong with the story tonight. Raging father, well, I'm hiding like a child who can't remember how to smile, and I'm buried by the snowstorm. I'm shaking from the cold, the traveler trapped inside the fold. But something is wrong with story tonight. I said something is wrong with the story tonight. Well, can you make it right? Sing sweetly to me. Sing sweetly to me. If I can't hold you, then nothing's worth the pain of all this I've endured. So if I can't hold you, there's nothing worse, and to the wicked world I'll die. Can you make it right? Can you make it right? Can you make it right?
Envision a future in which all learners of all ages may discuss issues and realities important to their learning with experts in every field who care enough about the future of humankind to share their expertise freely and thoughtfully. This future will come about through a melding of technologies, among which interactive video conferencing is central.